Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Today on the program, in honor of this being Women's History Month, we're going to learn about some of the first women to become doctors. You may have heard of the first woman to earn a medical degree in the United States. Her name was Elizabeth Blackwell. She had her MD degree conferred in 1849 from Geneva Medical College in upstate New York. Blackwell faced opposition, sexism, and outright hostility all along her journey. But through determination and somewhat deprivation, she carried on, inspiring many other women, including her younger sister Emily, to follow in her footsteps. In a new book called Women in White Coats, journalist and author Olivia Campbell recounts the story of the Blackwell sisters, along with other female medical pioneers like Elizabeth Garrett Anderson and Sophia Jex Blake in the United Kingdom. Olivia Campbell is an independent journalist, essayist, and author focusing on the intersections of medicine, women, history, and nature. Her work has appeared in The Atlantic, New York Magazine, Washington Post, The Guardian, Scientific American, and the science magazine Undark, among many others. Women in White Coats is her first book, and it's just out from Park Row. Olivia Campbell, author of Women in White Coats, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Olivia Campbell, welcome to Medical Monday. Congratulations on your new book, Women in White Coats. Let's start by where the book starts, by talking about Elizabeth Blackwell, who seems to be enjoying a moment here. It is Women's History Month, after all. Tell us a little bit about Elizabeth Blackwell and then maybe her sister Emily as well.
Well, Elizabeth Blackwell is definitely the most well-known woman in medicine in this country. She's had a few biographies written of her. This isn't like a lot of new information, but the idea of weaving her story with the other two women, that what's known about her work in the UK is a lot less known here. So Blackwell is from a poor family. Her father died when she was a teenager. So she has a neighbor who dies of cancer, who actually asked her, you know, why don't you become a doctor? You know, my male doctor has made my life so much more miserable. It's just even worse to go to the doctor than it is to not. So Elizabeth Blackwell's like, oh, I don't know, is there something I can actually do? So she starts to try to put the feelers out, and she finally applies to lots of different schools. Mostly she gets rejections. She finally gets accepted to a medical school. She has to work for many years as a teacher to be able to afford to go to medical school. But the one place that accepts her, Geneva College, actually accepted her. They thought it was a joke. The administrators didn't want to be the ones to say no to a woman, so they put it to the students. They get her application, and they say, okay, student body, what do you think? Should we admit a female student? And they think it's a joke from this neighboring medical college in New York, and they're like, oh, sure, yeah. But lo and behold, a few weeks later, appears a real woman in the class. So she actually didn't have too hard of a time there. She was asked to stay out of a few classes a couple times, and she had some guys throw like paper airplanes at her in class and stuff, but she kind of shot those down really quickly and was like, you know, I'm going to take all the classes that I'm supposed to take, and I'm not going to take your crap. Some other students, most of the students were a lot younger than her, so she was kind of like an older sister figure for them. But she had a terrible time when she tried to start professionally. She couldn't get hired. No hospitals would hire her in New York. No infirmaries, no dispensaries. So she founded her own little private practice and then still was getting not nearly enough patients to come to her. She was having to ration her food and her coal. She's running out of money. So she starts doing tours of lectures, talking to local families and beyond about women's health, trying to drum up some business. And this is finally what brings her more and more business, gets her on her feet. And she takes her lecturing. She really likes to speak publicly. So she takes her lectures to the UK. So in the UK, she does a tour all around talking about how amazing it is to be a woman in a profession, to have a job as a woman, how fulfilling it is for women to have a career. So Elizabeth Garrett is actually at one of these lectures. So she inspires Elizabeth to become a doctor.
Yeah, and that's kind of the through line of your book. They're separated, I guess, by, I don't know, 9 years, or that's the span of time between when Blackwell becomes a doctor and Garrett sees her or something like that?
Yes. Yeah, so Elizabeth Blackwell is much older than the other two women in the book, but she doesn't really seem to stop her. She's, you know, she's kind of a motherly figure. She has lots of little proteges that she, mentors. So I think she likes this kind of role. But yeah, then her sister, Emily Blackwell, who isn't very well known, and I think she'd be more well known. Emily is also in the book. She is the third woman in the U.S. to get her medical degree, and she also made it into a regular college. She was in Chicago. She got kicked out of the first medical college she was in, but then she found another one that would accept her. She only got kicked out because she was a woman. It wasn't any other reason. So then she comes back to New York once she's got her MD, and she and another woman that Elizabeth Blackwell has taken under her wing, Marie, they all found this woman's hospital together. So they're getting more and more patients than they can handle, so they're finally becoming popular. Women are finally realizing how amazing it is to go see a woman doctor. So they're getting, you know, they can't even handle the patients that want to be there. They're like turning pregnant women away that want to have their babies at the woman's hospital.
Yeah, so there's so much that I learned in reading your book. You know, I guess it wasn't maybe that surprising, being the first woman to get a medical degree in the United States, that Elizabeth Blackwell faced a lot of obstacles. But I guess it was surprising just how much hostility there was and just how much she not only had to master the academic material, but of course, fight the cultural war alongside. Now, you mentioned deprivation, that when she tried to start her practice, she had to, you know, almost went hungry and had to skimp on clothes and things. Now, I learned from your book that when she was doing sort of these apprenticeships, that she would often eat very bland food or very little food so as she would try to stave off showing emotion or fainting during surgeries or things like that.
Yeah, she's a little bit odd. I don't know. I always, like, the whole biography of Elizabeth Blackwell, I always think she's a little bit of an odd character. But, yeah, she's very much very simple, very plain. She doesn't like fancy clothes. She's very much about, you know, resisting temptations, you know, just excesses. She doesn't like excesses. But, yes, she doesn't want to be dramatic or be, you know, called out for being, you know, fainting or laughing or, you know, doing anything weird during, like, an anatomy dissection or something. So she's, yeah, she really limits her food intake. And so she's not, I know, she's, like, stoic about these things.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple other things I think are pretty noteworthy. One is that she has this opportunity, it sounds like, to be a part of the women's movement there in upstate New York, but she's really has almost no interest in joining this sort of nascent women's movement. On the other hand, she and her sister, Emily, were very keen on being equitable in providing medical services to people of all colors or incomes or immigration status. So it just seems, you know, perhaps a bit puzzling.
It was very odd. Her view of the women's rights movement at the time, she did not have a very great view of women, honestly. Like, and it's hard to wrap your head around, because here she is saying women should be allowed to be doctors. At the same time, she's saying, you know, women are silly. These women are frivolous. You know, they're little clubs over here for women's rights, so they don't know what they're doing. So, yes, it's very, I don't know how she made sense of it in her own head, but I found it very surprising that she was not supportive of these things, and especially in the private letters. Like, in the public, you know, statements she made, she wasn't so obvious, you know, against these women. But in the private letters I was reading, it was very much her calling these people silly and saying that most women were all about gossip and they weren't really ready for certain professions. And so, you know, and this is something that Elizabeth Garrett said, too. Like, all it would take is one flirting woman to ruin, you know, women going to medical school. It's like the one wrong kind of woman is just going to ruin this, our whole efforts in trying to show that women can do this. So I think it's connected to that idea that, like, they had to be the right, you know, kind of person. They had to be a certain kind of person to join their club of, you know, women doctors.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guest today is author Olivia Campbell, whose new book is called Women in White Coats, How the First Women Doctors Changed the World of Medicine. And change it they did. And Olivia, we were talking a little bit about Elizabeth Blackwell and Elizabeth Garrett, but a couple of other things that interested me about Elizabeth Blackwell. You had mentioned that in her educational process, it was very hard for her to get clinical rotations, and this was hard really for all the women to find suitable mentors or places where they could observe, and they had to really work hard in order to do that. Tell us a little bit about the Blockley Almshouse. That was something that was new to me as well.
Oh, wow. Yes. That was like the one place that Elizabeth Blackwell found to do her internship. And what was supposed to happen when on the break for from college was that she was supposed to get letters from the administrators of the college that like introduced her to an internship, which all the other students got. But she never got them. So she had to go find her own internship. She had to go beg around to see where she could find something. She had a place to stay in Philadelphia, so she went to the city there. She had a doctor friend who would help her apply to colleges in Philadelphia. She didn't get into any of them, but she used that as kind of a base to for her internship. And yeah, Blackley sounded kind of like a really interesting institution. The place really opened her eyes up to human suffering. It was a pretty transformational experience for her to see. It was for people with mental illnesses and physical illnesses. There's lots of people with STDs, you know, sex workers who've been ravaged by illness. So it's really people that couldn't afford, you know, better care would go there. And so she kind of saw the depths of what humanity was capable of. It really changed her perspective of humanity a lot, I think.
Yeah, and the last thing I wanted to ask you about Elizabeth Blackwell was on her lecture tours. I mean, everywhere, but in the UK, she was very keen at an early stage, I would say, even different than the education level she received, which is, I think, still true today, that in medical education, we don't really focus so much on nutrition or fitness. We focus more on pathology. But she was lecturing people, to women especially, to be physically fit, and schoolgirls as well, and saying that girls should be involved in sports and, you know, working out, not working out as we know it today, but, you know, doing vigorous exercise, basically.
Yes, there's a lot of things that men were taught, that boys were taught, that girls weren't taught. Sciences, mathematics, these advanced things, and also PE. Like, you know, boys would go out and wrestle and rough play and, the vigorous exercise, and where girls weren't getting that. Girls were being treated, you know, very prim and proper, and they just sat around. And these women saw so many of their relatives being, you know, much sick much more often than their male relatives. So they're kind of seeing the connection between, you know, being stuck in the house, sitting around at home all the time, and illness, not to mention the tight clothing, the heavy clothing, these kinds of things, the constant pregnancies. But yes, it was a really radical prescription for her to say girls should be getting exercise, like rough and tumble play, and they should be taught about their bodies. They should learn about what's going on inside their bodies. These were very extreme, these are new ideas. And I think they scared some people, but she was very into sanitation, also preventative medicine. Her hospital pioneered home health care workers, teaching mothers how to take better care of their households, their families, their children.
So let's turn our focus back to Elizabeth Garrett, who you've mentioned. And she was someone who was inspired by Elizabeth Blackwell to go into the field of medicine. And one of the things that was so interesting to me was that she was finally able to secure a spot in a medical school class. And what you taught me in this book was that men who were in the class often just showed up and were graded essentially based on attendance alone. And Elizabeth Garrett studied really hard and mastered the material and was kind of appalled that her classmates knew next to nothing about anything that was being talked about by the professors. And so medicine, and we think of it as this highfalutin, scholarly profession nowadays where there's lots and lots of tests to pass and hoops to jump through. But back then, it was sort of a place of last resort for people who had kind of botched other professions or other careers. That was really interesting to me.
That was crazy to me to hear that, like, you became a doctor after you failed at being a lawyer or a priest, or, you know, like, this was like a lesser profession, you know, did not have the reputation it has now. There was, like, medical students were brawling in the classrooms. You know, they were just really a rough bunch. They just showed up and sat there and to get their marks that they were present, and that's it. So, yes, that was incredible to me. And the fact that Elizabeth Blackwell, like, medicine was basically an undergrad degree. Like, it was not a huge deal. It was a couple of years of study and an internship and then an exam. You know, you write a dissertation and that's it. Most of these women went and got extra training after that. They would go, you know, get an even more advanced degree, or they would go study and be interns again somewhere, another hospital, because they knew that this wasn't enough. Elizabeth Garrett is working so hard, and she's so smart, and she watches these other guys just sitting around, you know, staring at the walls and getting the same, you know, education that she's trying so hard to get. It's just so unfair.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, people needing to seek other degrees. Well, so she, I guess, sat for an apothecary's exam, and unsurprisingly, perhaps as the only woman, she got the highest score on that exam. But something else that was interesting about these women that you write about is
You know, this is in the mid-1800s, and this is around the time, this is really pre-anesthesia. So we think of anesthesia entering the surgical realm around the time of the Civil War here in the United States. But so Elizabeth Blackwell and Elizabeth Garrett were witnessing surgeries that occurred oftentimes without anesthesia. And so they were kind of straddling the era when anesthesia started to be used regularly in surgery. And this was not very advanced stuff. This was, you know, ether and chloroform just knocking people out. This was not in any way regulated. And sometimes they, of course, over-anesthetized people and killed them. But I just thought it was interesting to note how, you know, in a way primitive and barbaric, you know, the medicine was back then. And so these women are having to contend with, you know, really the early ages of the medical scientific revolution on top of all the cultural battles they're having to fight just to secure their place in the school.
Right. So while they're also fighting sexism in general, they're also fighting this idea of medicine, especially surgery, as a heroic art, right? So before there was anesthesia, the main goal of a surgeon was to be fast and to be strong, right? And so that was male, right? So as fast as you can cut that leg off, that's how you do it, because that guy is awake the whole time. He's being held down or he's strapped down and he's screaming. So, you know, they're not looking for delicacy. They're not looking for intricacy. They're looking for speed and strength. They're coming in right when that's just starting to fade out, because they're just discovering ways to knock people out. So yes, they're fighting this grand idea of the heroic medicine. So there's this new science coming in at the same time. So it's also very interesting to see. Blackwell is a little bit more to the older side of this, and whereas the younger women, Garrett and Jex Blake and maybe even Emily Blackwell, are a little bit more into this new science aspect of it, and less about the caregiving and the old school medical approach.
Yeah, and to finish that thought on the whole rapidity or the quickness of doing surgery, you taught me also that many of these early surgeons thought using anesthesia was somehow wimpy or effeminate, because it was, you know, surgery was for tough guys, tough doctors to do. And I was appalled by that.
Yeah, there's really no limit to what society was telling women that they weren't supposed to be doing. I mean, and it wasn't just society. First of all, society was saying, well, you're de-sexing yourself because you're interested in this grotesque practice of medicine. Yes, medicine was very gross at the time, but that doesn't mean that you're automatically a man because you're interested in medicine. And they're saying women are too delicate. They're saying their brains are like physically, literally too small to understand science. They're not analytical. Their brains can't handle science. But then also they're facing their families. It wasn't just society that was scorning them. Their family might disown them if they said they were interested in medicine. There was one case where a mother said she'd rather see her daughter in an insane asylum than in a medical school. Elizabeth Blackwell's protege, Marie, when she graduated, she was like the fourth woman in the U.S. to graduate with a medical degree. She told her father, and her father said, well, if you were my son, I'd be so proud of you, but you're my daughter, so all I can do is weep. So this is what they're facing. Like, Elizabeth Garrett's mother is like goes into a depressive episode when she tells her she wants to be a doctor. It's just ridiculous to think of now.
Yeah, it was just so painful to read about, honestly. And Olivia, let's talk a little bit. Who is Sophia Jex Blake? She's another one of the characters in the through line of your book.
So Sophia is my favorite. She's this young upstart. She's got so much energy. She's got so much life. She will tell it like it is. She doesn't care what anybody thinks about her. And I just love this about her. I think a few other people really enjoyed that at the time, but I really love this about her. She and Elizabeth Garrett were kind of friends-ish. They moved in the same circles. They knew of each other. They would help each other out occasionally. But it wasn't until Sophia visited America, Marie, who was Elizabeth Blackwell's protege, moved to Boston to start a women's hospital there. And so Sophia, her lifelong dream was that she wanted to open a women's school. She wasn't necessarily a medical school, but a women's school. So she travels to America to do this tour where there women are allowed in colleges in America. So places like Oberlin College was co-ed, one of the first co-ed universities in this country. So she's doing this tour, talking to women academics and talking, just kind of seeing how this plays out, how advanced education for women works, so she can try and implement this in the UK. So while she stops off in Boston, she meets the woman of this women's hospital and really finally convinces her that this is what she should be doing. She should be going to medicine. So she goes back to her home in the UK, and she starts applying to colleges, and Edinburgh University says, well, we'd have to have a whole other set of classes for women. Like, we have to teach you separately, and we can't afford to do that if it's just one of you. So we would like for you to come, but you can't come because we can't afford that. So she's like, okay, fine. So she puts an ad in the newspaper. It's like, hey, does anybody else want to go to medical school with me? So she gets seven total women, or six other women, come and say, yeah, let's do this. And so she goes back to Edinburgh University and says, okay, I've got more than one woman. Let's do this. And they say, oh, okay, I guess you called us on it. We got to do this now. So they do their entire four whatever years. It's a lot more grueling in the UK than it was in the US. There's a lot more study going on for a medical degree.
Not only did you have to learn the science and things, you had to learn like Greek and Latin and all these things that would make it extra hurdles.
Yes, yes. The classics, you got all the, you know, philosophy, literature, all of it. So they work through and they do all the classes they need to get the degree, and the school refuses to grant them their degree. So they've done all the work and they still can't practice medicine. They can't legally practice in the UK without that MD or any kind of licensure. So she doesn't know what to do now. She's trying to decide what to do. She goes back home. She goes, okay, you know what? I'm going to open my own school for women to train to be doctors. This is ridiculous. I'm going to fix it. So she calls Elizabeth Garrett. She calls Elizabeth Blackwell, and she's like, okay, we got to set up a school, and I want you to be part of it, because if you're not part of it, it's going to be really obvious because you're such a big figure in this field, right? It's going to look bad for me if you're not condoning, you know, my enterprise over here. So she finally gets everybody on board, and they try to set up a school in London. It's the first women's medical school in the UK. The women can finally study without being harassed, without, you know, not earning the degree at the end, without having to suffer through all these things that they had to suffer through.
It really is an amazing story of obstacles overcome. Olivia, I'd like to turn for a second to your story. What led you to this interest in women and medicine and science, and has kind of formed the basis of a lot of your writing career?
Well, I used to be a ballet dancer. So I actually broke my foot in college and decided that I wanted a different degree. I wanted to do a different path. So I started writing about dance. I became a journalism major, started writing about the arts in general, started writing theater reviews, all kinds of stuff. And I realized I loved it. So I actually got pregnant in the last semester of college. My graduation occurred 3 days after I gave birth, but I managed to get it all in. I graduated. But I had a really traumatic birth experience. I almost died. My son almost died. And I had really, really terrible postpartum depression after that. But I didn't know that was it. I wasn't crying. Mostly I was really angry, and I was just really had no motivation to do anything, to participate in my life. And that really changed my interest over into women's health. I wanted to know, when I finally realized what was going on with me, I was like, why didn't I know this sooner? This was 13 years ago, so not a whole lot was being written about postpartum depression, about the fourth trimester, about women's health and reproduction. You know, things have changed now. They're better now. I think women are much more aware. But at the time, I just wasn't seeing, you know, what was right in front of me. And I wanted to know why. And so I started looking more into writing about women's health and women's health care and the history of women's health care.
Well, you have done a really sort of comprehensive job on this website with your writing, which is, I'll point it out here, oliviacampbell.contently.com, where you have a lot of your articles posted. There's an article right here on the front page in Parents Magazine called I Thought It Was Just a Bad Reaction to My Epidural, which is your firsthand account of going back to see the medical records of that traumatic birth experience. And what were the things that surprised you looking back that you didn't know about at the time?
It was, I feel like I really wasn't given options and I wasn't being told what was happening. That's what disturbed me the most. Like I requested the file because I feel like I didn't know what was going on while it was happening. Like, all I knew was that I passed out and I'm seeing stars and, you know, my mom is freaking out. My mom is a nurse. And so I knew it was bad when her face, you know, goes white and they're pushing her out of the way. Like, you know, things are going wrong, but I didn't know why. I had no idea the reason, you know, while it was happening or even afterward. They didn't really explain to me what was going on when my, you know, heart rate went really low, and my baby's heart rate went really low, and I passed out, and I didn't know why. Also, I had like a permanent contraction going on at the same time. Those were like two different things. So like my stomach was rock hard. So like the contraction didn't end. So I'm like, you know, starting to pass out. My stomach was rock hard and my mom was freaking out. So I just wanted to know what exactly was happening. So I started like researching what I found in that chart. I found like what medications they gave me and what amounts. The medication they gave me, they're not allowed to use that in childbirth anymore because of what happened, basically. It's because of the reaction that it caused, they stopped using it. So I found out a lot of interesting things and that I just wasn't told at the time.
Wow. Well, I mean, I think it's great that you were able to confront that and kind of go back and look at it and learn from it. I mean, that's the sort of thing that makes us all get empowered and so we feel like we're not going to be taken advantage of again. One of the other articles, and there's many here, dozens, but I was intrigued by this because it echoes something we hear a lot of today. It's in a magazine called Dame, which I was intrigued by. And I was wondering if you could tell us about that. But it's about a year ago, so right before the pandemic, you wrote an article titled Women Doctors Leaving Medicine is a Crisis. And in that, you report on a survey that showed fully 3/4 of women experienced gender discrimination in their profession. What were some other findings in that? And I guess this was before the pandemic. So do you have any sense or an update on what you think might happen after the pandemic when, you know, certain segments of the physician workforce have been, you know, overworked and fatigued and in some cases abused and not given the right personal protective equipment, at least early on in the pandemic?
Oh, I think the pandemic has just been a nightmare for women in every profession. And I can't imagine what it must have been like to be a physician or a parent and a physician, a parent and a caregiver to aging parents and a physician. You know, women have a lot on their plate right now. Kids are at home, you know, virtual learning, and it's kind of a nightmare. They're getting pushed out of their employment because, school isn't happening. So there's really hard decisions being made. Like either you hire a babysitter or, you know, you quit your job, basically. And I think it's really, the pandemic really exacerbated this pre-existing problem within medicine of it's really a boys' club. It's really very sexist. It's not flexible for caregivers as far as, like, you know, schedules. And it's not conducive to women's growth either. Women aren't promoted as much. They don't have the mentorship they need to be promoted. They're not, you know, being represented as leaders. The higher up you go in medicine, the fewer women you see in leadership positions. So, and because of so many women had to quit their jobs for the pandemic, this is only going to get worse. So, it was bad last year when I wrote about it, when they assigned me that feature. And it was heartbreaking to interview this woman in cardiology who basically said, this is fully a boys' club. She, you know, she almost regrets her decision to not have a family and to have a career instead. She said there's no way she could have had both, you know. The sexism that still exists in medicine is just unexcusable, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, you share in your book the sort of the origins of that and how hard it has been eroded. And you point out in this article that, for example, Harvard Medical School did not admit its first woman until 1945. Mm-hmm. And that now, mm-hmm. today, for the first time in the last couple of years, women actually are slightly more than half of the medical school population in the United States, and yet we still have these pay gaps and these status equity issues. The name of the book is Women in White Coats, How the First Women Doctors Changed the World of Medicine, and it's by our guest today, Olivia Campbell. Olivia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Olivia Campbell is an independent journalist and author. Her new book is called Women in White Coats, and it's just out from Park Row. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there. Sign up for your shot and get one as soon as you can.